once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. Boys and girl, or boy and girl, or maybe just ladies and gentlemen. Maybe just wishful thinking. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. I am live in the studio, and on the line with me is Elder Baldy. Are you there, Jeff McClure?
Well, if you're live in the studio, does that make me dead on the microphone?
No, you are live at home, hopefully.
I'm digitally present in the studio.
Yes, digitally present. How do you feel about being digitally present?
I feel like I'm in two places at the same time. Co-location.
Oh, co-location, yeah, that could be. I mean, maybe, possibly, or maybe not. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are...
Weird.
Weird. Yes, we are weird. We're also a radio program. Wait, you guys know that already. On top of all of being weird and a radio program, there is another organization with the same name that's run by the same people called the Personal Wealth Coach. It's an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they agree with anything that we're saying, or it doesn't mean they disagree with anything that we're saying. They do not confirm or deny anything. There is no quid pro quo, Senator. But there are the folks that if we say something ultra weird and maybe dangerous, they are the folks that you should contact to tattle on us. You want to do another disclosure for us, just for the fun of it?
We don't pay for the radio program, but we do pay for advertising on KTEM for the radio program.
Yes. The studio also pays for some advertising for the program. So it's weird. More weirdness. But we would let you know about that weirdness.
Well, they also don't pay us for the program.
Do you want to say the next one? This is your favorite one. You get to say a bunch of redundancies and speak lawyer speak.
This is really good stuff. I learned this from a lawyer. The information we present on this program is, well, we need to tell them that we don't give investment advice on the program.
We can. I'll do that one next, so you don't have two in a row. How's that?
Okay.
I'll do that one next, so that
you do it.
Yeah, that way we'll go back and forth and back and forth instead of two in a row from you. We'll stagger around like we do in our thinking. All right. So, even though the firm that also is named the Personal Wealth Coach is a fiduciary investment advisory firm, what we talk about on the air is not investment advice, unless we're describing what investment advice is. What we talk about on the air is purely educational, because if we were giving an investment advice, that by definition is custom tailored to the person hearing it. There is no one size fits all. And radio is kind of one size fits all. So what we can do is give you a bunch of tools to help you make the decisions rather than telling you how to make a specific decision. There. Now you can go on about your legalese.
The information that we have and we present for educational purposes on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of said information. Isn't that neat? I can deem and warranty and guarantee.
You know, as many times as you say it's neat, I just don't see it neat. I think it's overly redundant. It's like saying your coffee's hot.
I didn't order
it cold. But it's important. It has to be out there that we think the information that we've gathered is correct, but we can't guarantee it. Journalists get things wrong sometimes, and when we're reading stuff from a journalist, it might be wrong. Right, on top of that, the Congressional Budget Office gets things wrong sometimes, but if we're getting our data from them, then it's wrong. Usually, it's correct, and people are scoffing at that, but it is true. Most of the time, they're right. The vast majority of the time, they're right. But I still have trouble with the whole legalese and trying hard not to use too much economics jargon, but then we throw out the legalese at the beginning of the program.
I love the term deem, though. I mean, it's a good old-fashioned term.
I'll agree with history. Yeah, I like deem, but warranty or guarantee.
I like those, too.
You know, the difference is just the spelling.
Well, there's a difference between a warranty and a guarantee.
You can warranty an object that says, you know, going back, it's a written statement, a warrant, saying that you will honor your guarantee. So a guarantee doesn't have to be written. Okay. Are we writing anything on the radio program?
Yes.
Kind of oddly, maybe so, if you've got
writing, if
Siri.
It's being recorded, it's being written on a chip or a tape or something.
Yeah, right. All right. So what happened this week in the market besides silliness in our opening statements?
Well, the stock market did something different that it's done for the past 3 weeks, or actually 4 weeks before this one. It rose 1.52%. That's the SPX, or the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index. The it closed at 33.48.44. It's down about 6.5% from its high at the beginning of September. And later on in the show, or in the program, I like to talk about that particular dip in the market, but got technically didn't become a correction, but it did get decked. The midday on one day, it dropped down, it hit 10% below where it had been, which is technically a correction. So it did. It was an unusual thing, but it could provide us with some warnings about what's to come. The week, the swings in the value of the index this week were pretty dramatic. They would jump up and go down and jump up and go down and finally rally just a little bit at the end of the day on Friday, and that's why it got its 1.52% gain for the week. But the market leadership has shifted. And for instance, the stock market, the S&P 500, has been driven by about 10 very large cap high growth stocks that are mostly priced in the astronomical range. And that's what came down mainly. But something else happened this week. The mid caps, which is the middle sized stocks on the trading in the S&P 500 and the S&PX, the S&P 400 mid cap index, rose 4.71% this week, which is completely different from what it's done. It's down about 7.8% so far this year, while the stock market is still up about 3-point-something% from where it started the year. But it traditionally during this year, the mid-cap stocks have dropped faster and further and recovered more poorly than the big large-cap stocks that had big large-cap growth stocks anyway. And so the mid-cap stocks picked up. And the other thing that was unusual, the growth has beat value this year so far, I mean hard. The value side of the market is still down about 13% for the year, while the growth side is up about 11% for the year. But for the month of September, the Russell 1000 growth index fell 4.8%, while the value index fell only 2.6%. And for the week, the value index rose 1.63%, which indicates that what's going on is there's a turnover in the market. The value side of the market and the smaller size companies are actually doing better than the larger companies over the last week and over the last month. This will be really interesting if it changes. It takes some of the steam and the froth off the top of the market and makes it less likely there will be a market crash later on, like next year, which is what a lot of things are looking at. When the market gets this far out of whack with growth this far ahead of value and the large growth stocks driving the market, trading at multiples of their earnings that would take a century for the earnings of the company, the profits of the company to pay for the stock, you know that there's something out of whack. And the last time this happened was in 1999 and 2000, and we got a 50% drop in the market following that. I don't know that we're going to get that. I don't know that it's going to happen. There's a lot of things that said that it might, and there's a lot of things that said that it won't. So we'll see.
It's just a possibility at this point, a strong possibility in some people's opinions and a weak possibility in others. There's a lot of rumors that are going around right now. I mean, the president is ill. This is a weird time for the country. There's a big pandemic going on. But the reality is that we're kind of set for this in the market already, and we're kind of set for this in the economy already, and that we're not going to have a lot more layoffs because the president is sick. And I realize that we have a very prominent person that's ill. Very prominent, the most prominent person in the country is ill now. And what that should say is that this is very real. And I have a, do you mind if I throw in a personal story right in the middle of this?
Sure, go ahead.
This week I was in quarantine as well. My daughter went over to visit good family friends, and she spent the day over there, and everybody's taking precautions, and, you know, it's pandemic time, but still kids playing together are kids playing together, and there's only so many precautions you can take without saying, no, you can't play. And to some extent, we've said that a lot. Nope, can't play right now. Not with those kids or any kids that we don't know where they've been. Well, we made the exception, and they're fantastic family friends, and this was last Thursday, and we got the news on Sunday that one of the members of their household was in the hospital for COVID with pneumonia, doing fairly well, but you're in the hospital with pneumonia. How do you do fairly well doing that? So we immediately went to quarantine mode. This was on Wednesday. I guess it was Tuesday. So Wednesday I was at home. Thursday I was at home. We went in and got our tests done, and I got my negative result back in about 2.5 hours before the president got his positive result back in. And I think that's just kind of a little statement of this is a real thing. There are still people out there that think this is like an election year hoax. And they need to get their head in the game that if this is an election year hoax, go out and vote. But it's not a hoax if people you know are getting sick. It's a real thing. So, and people are still talking about how the posting of who's been sick and who's not been sick and all that stuff is being faked. I don't know that there's a better eye-opening experience than looking around at the president of the United States being in the hospital. That didn't happen for a hoax. So laying it out like that, wear your masks. We've been saying that for a long time. We try not to get political on this program. We try really hard. And it's surprising that for some reason COVID became political. I know why it started. But then it stayed afterwards. I actually know why that happened, too, and it's silliness. It started being political because throughout history, the first places to get sick in a pandemic, which has only been called a pandemic relatively recently in human history, before that it was just called a plague. The first places to get sick are the cities. Well, I can lay out kind of a demographic overlay, and I've said this before on the air, and it can help people understand the other aisle, if you will, across the aisle. In the city, and I've got good friends that live in Denver and in Austin and in San Francisco and in Manhattan. We got clients all over the country, and they're shocked when someone says that they need guns for home defense. Because all they have to do is pick up a phone, and there are police there within 2 minutes. Now, they're relatively well-to-do. That's partially why they're clients. So they live in good neighborhoods with very short response times by the police. So they can't imagine any reason why anybody would want a gun except to be a danger to those around them. And I explained to them that living in a small town in Texas, if you call the police on a weekend, you may get somebody there on Monday. So you should hope that all your neighbors have guns and know how to use them and know the proper approach and the responsibilities associated with the guns. So this is two very, very different experiences. This is why when people move to the big cities, they tend to become more liberal over time because they're looking at the greater for the most rather than the individual rights. Okay, so throughout history, what gets sick first in plagues? Cities. Well, our cities are mostly liberal right now. So it's an election year. And it's very easy to point at the cities and say the reason why you guys are getting sick and the people out in the country aren't is because you're liberal, you're Democrats. You've got something in your political makeup that's making this wrong.
Clearly, the fact that they're blue has made them sick.
Right. So then that was the founding story on the political side. and it stuck. Even though now the majority of illnesses that are occurring are outside the major cities in the red areas. And there's no more mismanagement in the red areas than in the blue areas. There's enough mismanagement to go around, I'll tell you that. But because that original dialogue started saying, hey, this is just the Democrats' problem, we're having trouble leaving that meme, if you will, and going on to this is an American problem. It's a global problem. How do we solve it? If this had happened 2 years ago, we may have all come together. I mean, we started to come together at the beginning of this. It was far enough from the election that we got a bipartisan CARES Act passed, and the president signed it as fast as he possibly could. And then as we got in more into the political year and more of the news was coming out, oh, it's mostly just the blue areas that are being hit. Well, the next stimulus package got stalled and stalled and stalled. And now the people that really need the stimulus package are purple. They're both red and blue. But because so much of that prior statement was about it being a hoax or it's an election year, whatever, now we have to go back and change opinions on the red side. The red side has to change its own opinions about itself so that they can get the need that they need, the things that they need, from government in a time of pandemic. And that's when the government should be stepping up, during wars and massive natural disasters, and pandemics fall under that category in my mind. The government needs to step in and provide assistance. It's too big for the insurance companies to handle. Okay, so now I've kind of laid out, why did I say that on an economics radio program? Because we have said all along, there are three pillars to getting a recovery here. And the first one is so much bigger than the others that it's there as afterthoughts. And the first one is we need a vaccine out. We need something to stop the spread. But in the meantime, the Federal Reserve needs to keep being careful and making sure banks are strong. And the U.S. government needs to pass stimuluses that we figure out how to pay back. I wouldn't mind if they passed at the same time they're passing the stimulus, something that said, and here's how we plan to pay it back. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Not right before an election.
Right. So we've got these three pillars, and the vaccine is coming. But I had some conversations with people in the know. I also have read everything I can get my hands on things like when is the Moderna vaccine going to be available? It looks like in March. The trials may be done in January or February. What about the Oxford AstraZeneca trial? Well, it was put on pause. It looks like it may get finished if the FDA can step back a little bit. It may get finished. They're continuing the trials, but the FDA may require more oversight on them. May get finished in February, right?
Well, there's some trials, stage three trials, that'll probably finish in November.
Right.
But here's the problem.
Regulatory oversight comes next.
Well, here's the problem. The trial will simply say two things. Number one, in a very short period of time, nobody got intolerably sick because they took the vaccine. And number two, it was effective at reducing the number of infections by at least 50%. In other words,
right.
if only half the people who got vaccinated got COVID, then it's good. It's good to go. Now, here's the problem. A lot of the side effects from a vaccine, if there are going to be any serious side effects, may not show up for several months. So fast-tracking a vaccine through the stage three trials and saying, let's give it to everybody.
Especially ones that we're going to give to a lot of people. Yeah.
They give to everybody. Testing 330 million people with a vaccine that we don't know what the long-term side effects are probably would be a worse situation than letting the disease run a little longer.
So what we're saying here, and I know this is a difficult pill to take, is that we need to keep in our minds that it may be June before we get effective vaccinations in large enough numbers. So it may even be later than that if things go poorly. So just keep in mind that there is no quick and easy finish to this. It's going to draw out. It's going to drag out. So you need to continue to make plans on, if you're a business, how do you maintain profitability? If you can't, then you need to be getting with your congressperson and saying, get the bill passed. Because if a good company goes under based on this natural disaster, it is the government's role to help with that. If they want to keep receiving tax revenue, they need to make sure businesses remain open.
Let me give you an example of why the businesses are still going to be struggling. Let's just say I'm in the high-risk group, so because I'm old enough and got pre-existing health conditions. Let's say I get the vaccination, and based on the stage 3 trials, it's 55% effective. That means I still have a 45% chance of going out. If I go out and make contact with a lot of members of the public, I still have a 45% chance of getting the disease. And let's just say, as we have read yet again.
I gotta say this. The statistics are a little bit weird. It's not a 45% chance of getting it if you're exposed. You have a 45% chance at a time when there was a 100% chance. So that's you don't have a 100% chance of getting it even when you're in the same house with someone, because my test came back negative. My family's test came back negative, and the house had someone in it who's now hospitalized. So go ahead.
If I may encounter somebody, let's say I go into a restaurant, and the person at the next table has the virus and is spreading it unknowingly or knowingly, and is breathing out and chewing and talking, and the virus gets over to me, and I've already had the vaccination. I'm not immune to the virus. I'm just have a lower probability of being infected.
That is the lowest scale of accepted vaccination. The ones that are being tested right now, we're hoping that they have a much higher success rate than 50%, but that's the FDA's level.
I'm giving a scenario that could happen. So if we determine that it's effective enough that I would still get the vaccination because I want to lower my probability of getting the disease, but I probably won't go out to a restaurant, which means the economy will still be suffering. If we get 50% or better immunity from the vaccination and the whole population gets inoculated, it'll pretty much wipe out the spread of the disease. However, if a third of the population says, I'm not going to get vaccinated, I'm just going to keep spreading the disease, we are still going to have an impact on the economy because there's going to be a lot of people, who, particularly those at risk, who simply are not going to go to places where they congregate with a bunch of people.
Right, and this is the next layer on that. Hopefully, you know, vaccinations would improve over time. This is something that's really, really important for people to understand. This isn't going to go away. The coronavirus as we know it, we're probably going to have to be vaccinated for it every year, kind of like the flu, only with a higher priority, because the flu doesn't kill as many people by any stretch. So this concept that we'll get the vaccination and now coronavirus is gone, we don't have the intestinal fortitude to do what we did with smallpox. Not only that, the world is not respectful enough of us to do again what we did with smallpox. What do I mean by that? Well, the entire world bonded together to eradicate smallpox. That's not going to happen right now. There are lots of countries that don't want to have any vaccination from any Western company. And there can be people out there going, well, fine, they deserve to get sick then. Except that if they maintain the disease out in the wild, it spreads again. And that's if we could wipe it all out across the entire planet all at once. Those of you who are old enough remember the polio vaccines in the United States, where everybody had to go and get it, and it was mandatory. That would cause people today to do things that I can't repeat on the radio, because people would say, you're taking away my freedom by making me do this, when, you know, this occurred in a time period when a lot of people think we were more free, a lot more free than we are today. So there are some things that the government needs to have the ability to impose, like don't kill each other. This is something that governments are for. drawing the line on where the government's allowed to take over is an important factor. And right now, public opinion is that they don't have the right to tell me I have to get this vaccination, even if it's for the better public good. So that means that the disease is going to be around for longer. It means that even if we tried to do 100% vaccination of everybody in the country, it could still be an issue because we don't know how long the antibodies last. What we do know is they seem to decay over time, and it looks like 3 months, some people are ready to get infected again. Other people maintain immunity. It depends on how severely they were sick and a lot of other things. So keeping that in mind, this is a long-term thing we're going to have to deal with. So let's start building the tools to deal with it in your own business and in your own life. I wouldn't be surprised to see masks on people's faces occasionally or even in large numbers in 2 years.
Well, from my perspective, we went for a while when we knew the disease was around without wearing masks and without doing a lot, changing our behavior a lot. Once it got to Texas and got into Bell County, then it was pretty obvious we needed to change our behaviors. If we get to the point where the disease is no longer spreading in Bell County, the disease is no longer spreading in Texas, then we can return to normal behavior. And that probably, the estimates vary, but it's sometime next year is the probable time that that will happen, according to the people who
right.
have more experience in this than I do.
And this is something else that we have some benefit in that our family, you know, those of you that don't know, Elder Baldy and Younger Baldy are related. Elder Baldy is the clone of Younger Baldy. You know how Dolly the sheep got older when she was cloned. Well, this is how we explain that away.
How'd you plant those false memories of you being born in my mind?
You saw Total Recall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a sci-fi movie stuff that we did. That's what was going on. So he has a daughter and I have a sister that lives in Denmark. She's a brilliant neuroscientist, and I'm not exaggerating. That's really what she does. And she works for a major corporation there studying kids' brains and trying to figure out better ways for kids to learn STEM stuff. They don't wear masks in Denmark. But they did for a while. They now have 300 active cases of COVID-19 in Denmark. Well, how did that happen? They had a massive lockdown across Europe that lasted a lot longer than ours. And now they still have border controls in place at every country's border. We can't do that in the United States. Part of the Constitution is freedom of passage from one state to the next. If we had checkpoints at every border between Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Louisiana, and every other state border at every place where roads cross it, we could do a massive lockdown and maybe stop the spread. But we can't do that. It's unconstitutional, and none of us would stand for it.
Well, the big thing they do there is if somebody has the disease, discovered to have diagnosed with the disease. They do a lot more testing than we do.
Oh, yeah.
If they find somebody who's positive, they immediately start looking for the people they've been in contact with and test them.
They go to them to test them. I also have a really good friend. Go ahead.
They put them in quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they have these little outbreaks, they shut them down very, very quickly.
I have a good friend in Australia. And when there's an outbreak in a city in Australia, the Australian army goes door to door and tests everybody and tells everybody that they need in that entire neighborhood that they need to stay home. So they test everybody. They get the results back in one day. And the only people that need to continue to quarantine are the people that had a positive result. So there's a lot of different experiments, if you will, going on around the world. Of how to handle this. In Australia, we generally think that they have the same kind of rights that we do, and it's not the case. I mean, if the United States Army imposed a lockdown and said that you cannot leave your house for more than 1 hour every day, and that includes getting groceries, walking the dogs, and everything else, and we're going to track you on your phone to do it, I think there would be a minor revolt in the United States, but that's what they're doing in Australia. You are required to have your phone with you when you leave your house. If they find that you don't have your phone with you when you leave your house, you have to prove that you don't have a phone. If you have a phone, you're in trouble. Because that's how they're tracking your movements. Now, that sounds dystopian to me. What the Chinese did to stop COVID sounds dystopian to me. They just shut everything down and enforced it draconically. If you were out and about, you were going to prison. So we're taking a much more free approach, but in that process, we're also having a lot more sickness.
We didn't give out how to contact us.
Let's do
that.
We're
live right now. If today is October the 3rd, and you can contact us via email, either at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We do have one question already in.
So yeah, it came in before the program started even.
Okay, and I haven't finished the markets yet either, but go ahead and get the question.
Okay.
The question was, can you explain the rise of SPAC, S-P-A-C, and blank check deals and what they are? Thanks. It's from John.
Thank you, John, by the way. Just as a side note, you are consistently a great question asker. We really appreciate that.
SPAC stands for a Special Purpose Acquisition Company. And it's a blank check company. Well, there's other companies, too, that are blank check companies. Basically, a SPAC does an IPO, and it's a very simple IPO, an initial public offering to gather money for the stock market. And they sell their stock, and it's very simple because they don't have to present anything. It's a shell company. They don't have to present any balance sheets or anything because they don't have any expenses to speak of. They have very minor expenses. They have no debts. And they said, we're just going to accumulate a lot of money, and we'll do something with it later. Now, generally speaking, they have 2 years to buy or invest in something, but they won't tell you what it is.
I'm going to give you – let me give an example of one real quick, one that I think a lot of people will – understand. It didn't start out as a SPAC. It didn't start out as a special acquisition company. It went public, and now when people buy into that stock or buy new shares released by that stock, and that's Virgin Galactic. So Virgin Galactic, they're using the money to do a new company that's not profitable at all right now. I mean, it's the opposite of profitable. There's been zero money paid into it except through investor money so that they can take people up into orbit. That's a special acquisition company. That's one of the ones that is much more transparent. A lot of the SPACs out there, I can't say SPAC company because the C in SPAC is company. That would be like calling it a spa company. It's like an ATM machine. I've got problems with that. Anyway, so a lot of the other ones, they don't tell you what they're going to buy with the money. Virgin Galactic, you could say, all right, they're going to go to space. They've got it in the name. So here you go. Richard Branson, figure out what to do with this money. And that's a SPAC.
One SPAC that people are very, very familiar with and they don't think of it as a SPAC is Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway.
That's right.
Which was just a shell company when they went public. It didn't own – it used to be a company that manufactured textiles. But when he bought it, that's what it was, but it had gone bankrupt. It's a company that acquires other companies or acquires portions of other companies, but you're not told what it's going to acquire until it does. People buy that because Berkshire Hathaway has done well, and it's done well because of the judgment of one man. Generally speaking, when a SPAC forms, it's because somebody, some known investor, as I said, me and five, six other people that you've heard of are going to go and invest some money. We can't tell you what it is because that would complicate the IPO. Just give us a bunch of money and we'll do something with it, and we think we can make a profit.
These companies tend to spring up when there's a lot of money around. Now, there's a lot of money around right now. I realize that people are saying, what do you mean there's a lot of money around? A lot of money is sitting in bank accounts not being spent. People that have lost their jobs are hoarding whatever savings that they can. If they still have their jobs, they've paid off or are paying off their debt, and they're holding on to as much money in their bank account as they can. Well, what happens to that money? Some people want to jump onto Robinhood or onto E-Trade and start doing day trading with that money. Other people say, I'll let somebody else do the day trading with that money, and thus the SPAC is out there. And that's they spring up when there's a lot of money. There's more risks around them than in most investments. That's just a heads up out there that if you're like, I'm going to get involved in a SPAC company, well, first figure out what it stands for. And it's not spackling on the walls when you're about to paint. It is for special acquisitions. Well, what kind of special acquisitions? Sometimes it's for loans. They give people loans from the company. Go ahead.
There's now an ETF that's just been filed, SPAK, which is even more crazy than investing in a SPAC, because it's an ETF that's going to buy SPACs.
And they don't even know how to spell company. It doesn't start with a K.
Well, the point is, it reminds me of a book that is worth reading. I think every investor who actually tries to buy stocks or something should read it. It's called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And it's by McKay. And it is really worth reading, even though it was written in the, I think it was written in the 1800s. The point is, during the South Sea Bubble, which was the first carefully recorded stock market bubble and was in England, there was a company that was formed that said, we're taking money for investment for purposes unknown as yet, but will be announced later. And it received a tremendous amount of money, and its stock went up dramatically, and people started buying it because the stock was going up. And about 6 weeks later, it was worth nothing. And the people who formed the company just left with the money. And that,
well, that was that, nice of them.
When I read that, and admittedly, I read that first read that book 25 or more years ago, I thought that's completely insane. Why in the world would anybody invest in a company that has no balance sheet, that has nothing, and simply to say, give us the money and we'll invest in something, and today we have SPACs. So it may be crazy, but it's going on. And it's extremely dangerous. Initially, the SPACs were only open to sophisticated investors who had really had an insider idea of what the guy was going to, whoever was running the company was going to do with the money. But today, they just do it. And people, and now common investors with as little as $10, believe it or not, can invest in this, in these things.
Yikes.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, at least with $10, you're not going to lose a lot. $10.
Well,
you could lose $10.
We got a situation where people, like you said, have a lot of extra money. They have a lot of money they pulled out of something, and they have a lot of time on their hands, and they're looking around at something trying to make some money. And the backside to that, yields are so amazingly low. I read an interesting quote today, this morning, as I was researching for the show. Fixed income is all fixed and no income.
Right. But at the same time, and I'm going to say the name of a company here, just like we said a minute ago, one important thing that we need to tell you about this is we are absolutely not recommending the things that we're talking about right now. We don't recommend investing in individual stocks. We think you really need to know what you're doing to do that. But in order to give some examples of what's happening in the world, we're going to tell you some symbols. And one of them, to show you where we are as far as, you know, people ask what are value, what are growth. Citigroup. People go, oh man, a bank. What are we talking about, a bank? Citigroup has a price to earnings ratio of 7.5. What does that mean? It means that it would be 7.5 years before their earnings right now would pay for the price of the stock. Typically, the average in the S&P 500 is around 15. So this is half of that. It would say that would be 50% under value for a normal year. There are other companies out there, Amazon, Tesla, that are measured in the thousands of price to earnings ratio, like you would have had to invest in the Roman Empire to get earnings that would pay for the stock by today. One thing, why, what else about Citigroup? I'm not saying this to sell you on it. I'm saying this very clearly to say there's a lot of companies out there that are extremely undervalued and still profitable. So when I look at the market capitalization, that means if you added up all the stocks and multiplied by the stock price for this company, the market cap is about $91 billion. That's pretty big, but it's not as big as, you know, Apple and the trillions. It's a decently sized company. Everybody knows who Citigroup is. Okay, so now I'm going to go look over at the balance sheet and see what their assets minus their liabilities are. That means what does it own minus all its debt? And if we've got a $91 billion value, according to what the market is valuing it at, if you just look at their assets minus their liabilities, and for a bank, a liability is any deposit you have that you could withdraw. It's a debt that they have to pay you when you call it. You could leave it there a long time or you could remove it. So that's a liability. We're taking out deposits as the liability. We're just looking at the assets minus liabilities. $193 billion. If Citigroup went bankrupt today, the stock price across the board's at $91 billion, but after they liquidated their assets, and I'm going to say that they would get less than what they're valuing at, we'll even say they get tremendously less, if you would still make a profit on the stock purchase. Now, that implies that they're not going out and getting new debt and they're still managing their company well. There's a lot of due diligence that you need to do. This is an example to show what we're talking about when people talk about the K-shaped economy, that these big, big, big tech stocks that don't have a huge amount of profit or no more profit than they did before, sometimes less profit than they did before, have more than doubled over a year. While other companies are being knocked down, this is us saying, look, when reality returns and people are looking at their investments based on, is this a good investment rather than is this one that's grown a lot lately? And that's two ways of making your decisions. The ones that ask, has it grown a lot lately? That is another way of saying, I'm going to buy high. Everybody knows buy low, sell high. And yet, when it comes down to it, we say, well, what's going up? So we buy high. This is just as an example across the board. There's a lot of companies that are popping up that are new and trendy. The SPACs are coming out and saying, give us a bunch of money, and people are giving it to them at the same time that they're taking money away from companies that are well-managed, profitable, doing great, and are now dirt cheap. So I think those were some examples. Again, none of those companies are recommended by us.
The important thing to realize is another thing about Citigroup, since we're talking about Citigroup, we're not recommending Citigroup. The yield on that company right now, the dividend yield is 4.67%. In other words, if you buy the stock, and I'm not suggesting you do, if a person buys the stock and they just hold it without regard to the price of the stock, they're getting almost 5%, well, up 4.5% interest each year, which just beats the heck out of any place. Matter of fact, that was any place else you could go. As a matter of fact, that's what I was going to talk about is the bond market. The fact that the bond market is paying, if you get something that's only reasonably risky in the bond market, and I say reasonably risky, the slight chance of default, very slight chance of default, you're going to get 1, maybe 2% interest. And what that boils down to is that's not enough to live on. That's not as much as inflation is going to be. So people who've been used to living on fixed income, who used to getting, if you're in Texas, for example, and you go looking for CD rates, you're going to get 0.5%, 0.6%, something like that. Now, if you're willing to go online and go across the country and hunt around, you can get 1-point-something% out of something. But it's just no place to find enough interest to live on. So people are getting a little desperate. And very frankly, we've talked about this before, the value side of the market. I'm not recommending you buy any individual stock. But if you're invested in the value side of the market and broadly diversified, you'll notice something interesting pops up. That 4.67% dividend is not that unusual. A lot of companies that are AAA rated companies have stocks that are paying dividends and have paid dividends for many years and don't have any evidence that they're going to stop paying dividends, are paying much higher interest rates than you find anywhere in bonds. So it's not that you can't find someplace to go. It's just that you have to think outside the box just a little bit.
And they're not, and I'm going to use a word that people are like, why do you keep using that word? They're not, I was going to say sexy. They're not something that will cause a great deal of prestige when you say these names, because they're not trending right now. If you say, I own Amazon and Tesla and Apple, people go, ooh, wow. If you say, I own a bank stock, they're like, yeah, what are you doing that for? But the reality is that if you have a good company that's undervalued, that's where you're more likely to make profit. And if they're paying a good dividend, and what you were saying, the 4.6% dividend yield, that's pretty nice. Now, there's risks associated with all of this, but we have another question that's popped up.
We do. You want to address that one?
Sure. He often sends a picture of the Wall Street Journal to say what article he's talking about, but it's a very simple question. What's the difference between prime money markets and regular money markets? What is a prime money market? And this is another one of those areas where investment jargon kind of gets in the way. Prime is the most versatile of money markets. It can invest in the most things. It can go to corporate debt, treasury debt, governmental debt of all types. It can do municipalities. It hasn't limited itself. A government money market fund is going to be the vast, vast majority of it, and I think it's above 99%, has to be invested in U.S. Treasury securities or government securities like backed by the U.S. government. Then there's Treasury funds It's just standard U.S. treasuries in there. They're not going to other governmental entities besides U.S. treasuries there, but they haven't limited themselves to be quite as much as 99% in there. Then there's a treasury fund. So a lot of these are like, what kind of assets are held inside? Treasury funds, government funds, prime funds, and municipals. I'm trying to do this off the top of my head. So a municipal, it's invested, and that's generally something called like a tax-exempt money market fund. They're investing in very short-term debt for cities and states. Why short-term? Well, money market funds are intended to maintain a very level value. And the shorter the maturity, this is the shorter distance between now and when the debt gets paid back in full, the less volatility, the up and down movements, the less interest rates affect them. So that's kind of across the board in all money market funds. They're going to be in very, very short duration. Duration just means it's like the balance point when that maturity value weighs as much as the interest payments that you're getting monthly. Okay, I think that was maybe too technical an answer, but tried to get as much information packed into it as I could.
There's a lot going on there right now because the interest rates are very, very low. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the expense ratio on the typical mutual fund, the ones I've looked at recently, the expense ratio is higher than the yield could possibly be at this point.
Well, they've cut. In a lot of cases, what they're doing is that they are replacing existing money market funds with other existing, like, institutional share class, very low expense classes. If you get a paper in the mail or an email saying, hey, your money market's been replaced, it's because the one you were in had high expenses and you would have a negative yield right now.
And so one of the problems with prime money market funds and any money market fund that just invests anywhere it wants to invest is it has to hold some really big reserves like banks do since the money market panic that occurred during the Great Recession.
And a little one in March, too, where the Federal Reserve had to step in and shore up some money markets.
So the Federal Reserve has stepped in a couple of times and backstop money market funds to keep there from being a run on the money market. Well, actually, not so much in March, it wasn't so much a run on the money market funds. And it happened last year about this time, too. There just wasn't enough money to go around to make the money market funds work. So the Federal Reserve had to step in and do some things they don't normally do. So they put restrictions on regular money market funds. So they have to have big reserves, and their yields have dropped to effectively zero. Now, if they invest in treasuries, which is why you'll see a change from money market funds to treasuries, they don't have to have the big reserves, and they can actually pay something out and people to give them money.
We've got to play some commercials real quick. We'll be back for just a very short period to just give some contact information. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. It's like the volume got weird on us. Strange. Can you say some words here?
Some words here.
All right. You want to do a quick wrap up for this hour, and we'll be back next hour.
We talked about the markets, which rose just a little bit this week. They're still down from the peak at the beginning of September, and that the coronavirus is still very much with us, and we'll have a lot more to talk about next hour.
Yeah, if you'd like to contact us off the air, you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. If you want us to answer the question on the air, we can do that as well. You can call us locally at 254-947-1111, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can download radio podcasts and read our newsletters going back and sign up for our newsletters. You can also contact us directly through the contact form there, and we do read those things. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.